Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. President Donald Trump has issued threats to colleges and universities in an effort to quell protests, but civil liberties experts say his executive orders and threats on social media violate the Constitution, free speech, and due process rights for students. We'll have details on our show today. Hantavirus has claimed the life of actor Gene Hackman's wife. The rare but often deadly virus has been found in rodents here in San Diego County in recent months, including East County's mountain areas. Stay tuned for tips on how to protect yourself. Another disease making headlines is bird flu, which can also wipe out backyard flocks. Learn more on our show today. San Diego County is preparing its annual budget, and supervisors want your input. Find out how to make your voice heard. Tara Lawson-Reamer, chair of San Diego's supervisors, is warning that Trump's budget and staffing cuts are hurting local service providers. Plus, hear about a lawsuit filed by educators and others challenging the Trump administration's efforts to eliminate diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, in higher education. Then, from California News Service, we'll have a report on concerns over the growing dominance of corporate-controlled agriculture. On part two of our show today, we'll have a special report on how the Trump tariffs and trade wars are impacting local businesses and drawing opposition even from the normally conservative U.S. Chamber of Commerce. On Destination East County, hear about some fun and festive events coming up, from St. Patrick's Day festivities to Nature Day on Mount Helix. From Public News Service, we'll have some national news stories on a potential recession, more on the Trump tariffs, and concerns over zoonotic diseases, among other things. On Green Scene, hear how mass firings are impacting our national parks, including those right here in California. After the recent storm's heavy rains, we thought this would be a good time to replay our Sound of History episode on one of the worst storms ever to hit the San Diego region, Hurricane Kathleen. And finally, on the Yonder Report from Public News Service, learn about impacts of a farm funding freeze, chaos on our public lands, and federal firefighting cuts that could impact public safety across the West, including here in San Diego's East County, where Cleveland National Forest could be affected. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
President Donald Trump, on his social media account, has threatened to stop all federal funding for any college, school, or university that allows illegal protests. He added, "Agitators will be imprisoned or permanently sent back to the country from which they came. American students will be permanently expelled or, depending on the crime, arrested." Those threats are illegal and unconstitutional, according to legal and civil liberties experts. Trump's post comes on the heels of two executive orders which seek to pressure higher education officials to target immigrant students and staff for exercising First Amendment freedom of speech rights, including pro-Palestinian protesters or students critical of the U.S. government, culture, institutions, or founding principles. Trump's Truth Social post goes further, demanding that even students who are U.S. citizens be expelled and imprisoned for participating in campus protests if deemed illegal. The Foundation for Individual Rights in Education and the American Civil Liberties Union have both issued statements criticizing Trump's actions for pressuring colleges and universities to engage in conduct that would violate the U.S. Constitution and other laws. While violence or intimidation of individuals based on religious views or national origin are already illegal and should not be tolerated on campuses, freedom to express controversial ideas is a core principle of higher education, and the ability to criticize governments and their policies is a critical component of our democracy, the civil rights legal experts make clear. In its statement, the Foundation for Individual Rights, or FIRE, notes that while colleges can and should respond to unlawful conduct, the president does not have unilateral authority to revoke federal funds, even for colleges that allow illegal protests. If a college runs afoul of anti-discrimination laws, such as Title VI or Title IX, the government may deny the institution federal funding, but only by taking it to federal court or via notice to Congress and an administrative hearing. It is not a discretionary decision that the president can make. Moreover, the group adds, President Trump also lacks the authority to expel individual students who are entitled to due process on public college campuses and almost universally on private campuses as well. Fire voices concern that Trump's recent message will have a chilling effect on student protests over the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, especially when paired with his recent executive order adopting what Fire calls an unconstitutional definition of anti-Semitism and another order threatening to deport international students for engaging in protected expression. Threatening schools with the loss of federal funding will result in a crackdown on lawful speech, Fire predicts, adding that even the most controversial political speech is protected by the First Amendment. The American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU, has sent a letter of support to colleges and universities urging them to protect campus speech and making clear that government cannot threaten to defund universities for fostering an environment of free speech and free inquiry. The letter urges colleges and university officials to reject federal pressure to survey or punish international students and faculty over constitutionally protected free speech. In the wake of Trump's executive orders titled Protecting the United States from Foreign Terrorists and Other National Security and Public Safety Threats, and a second order titled Additional Measures to Combat Anti-Semitism, the ACLU also voiced concerns that Trump's Truth Social posts threatening arrest or deportation for agitators, including arrest of American students. It is disturbing to see the White House threatening freedom of speech and academic freedom on U.S. college campuses so blatantly, says Cecilia Wang, legal director of the ACLU, in a statement issued after Trump's Truth Social threats. She continues, "We stand in solidarity with university leaders and their commitment to free speech, open debate, and peaceful dissent on campus." She said, "Truth's latest coercion campaign, attempting to turn university administrators against their own students and faculty, harkens back to the McCarthy era and is at odds with American constitutional values and the basic mission of universities." The ACLU's letter outlines four principles that campuses should adhere to when addressing campus speech. Colleges and universities should encourage robust discussion and exploration of ideas by students, faculty, and staff, regardless of their nationality or immigration status. Colleges and universities are not obligated to act as deputies in immigration law enforcement. Schools must protect the privacy of all students, including immigrant and international students, and schools must abide by the 14th Amendment and Title VI of the Civil Liberties Act. Esha Bhandari, Deputy Director of ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project, concludes, "The federal government cannot mandate expulsion of students or threaten funding cuts to punish constitutionally protected speech on campus, while the administration can enforce Title VI to ensure a learning environment free from harassment. It cannot force universities into adopting restrictive speech codes that silence the viewpoints the government disfavors." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Henry Migala.
This is Miriam Raftery with a health report. An autopsy has determined that actor Gene Hackman's wife, Betsy Arakawa, died of hantavirus pulmonary syndrome. The couple was found dead in their Bel Air home. Hackman, who was 94, died days later of heart disease and complications of Alzheimer's. His wife, Arakawa, was 65 years old. Her death shines a spotlight on hantavirus, a rare but often deadly virus spread by inhaling particles from rodent droppings. The disease is fatal about 40% of the time. Hantavirus was first identified in 1993 after a respiratory outbreak in the Four Corners region of the southwestern United States. Between 1993 and 2024, 864 cases have been reported nationwide, confirmed in laboratory results, the Centers for Disease Control reports. Of those, 834, nearly all, were hantavirus pulmonary syndrome, the most dangerous form. The other 30 were non-pulmonary hantavirus infections. Nearly all of the cases in the United States, 94% of them, have occurred west of the Mississippi River, affecting both children and adults. Here in San Diego County, our county has been testing wild rodents for hantavirus since 2008. Mice have been found positive primarily in rural, mountain, and desert areas. Last year, 25 cases of hantavirus locally were confirmed by laboratory testing. So far this year, 9 cases of hantavirus have been confirmed in deer mice locally as well as in a western harvest mouse. 4 of those were in Rancho Cuyamaca State Park and the rest were in Escondido. Symptoms of hantavirus may appear from 1 to 8 weeks after exposure to rodents or their droppings. Early symptoms may include severe muscle aches, chills and fever, headache or dizziness, difficulty breathing, coughing, nausea, vomiting, stomach pain, and in severe cases, respiratory failure. So it's important to contact your doctor right away if you have these symptoms, especially if you know you've been exposed to rodents. While there is no vaccine or treatment, medical care can help reduce the symptoms of hantavirus. Here are some steps you can take to prevent exposure. Keep rodents out of homes, cabins, sheds, or other structures by sealing all entry holes the size of a dime or larger that mice can squeeze through. Air out unused structures at least 30 minutes before you enter. Cover or store away pet food dishes, and trash cans with rodent-proof lids. Remove wood piles, trash, and old cars where rodents may nest. Store hay and firewood at least 100 feet away from buildings. Cut grass, remove weeds, and trim bushes near buildings, too. If you see signs of mice, use mouse traps to catch them. If you must clean up rodent-infested areas, be sure to wear a protective face mask as well as latex or rubber gloves. Do not stir up dust by sweeping or vacuuming rodent droppings, urine, or nesting materials. Instead, use the wet cleaning method. Make a disinfectant solution of 10 parts water to 1 part bleach, or you can use a commercial disinfectant. Spray this solution on rodent nests, droppings, and any dead rodents, and let the solution sit for at least 20 minutes. Then, soak sponges in the disinfectant solution and clean the area thoroughly. Put all infested materials, such as nesting, droppings, and dead rodents, in a sealed plastic bag, or better yet, double bag it, then throw it away. Wash and discard gloves and sponges in plastic, and then thoroughly wash your hands. You can find more information on hantavirus at cdc.gov or at the San Diego County Health Department.
With egg prices through the roof, more people are taking an interest in raising backyard chickens. But experts warn that comes with significant risk because avian flu is spreading rapidly. You might think backyard chickens are safer from bird flu than large commercial farms because the flocks are smaller and coops are less crowded, but Professor Benjamin Anderson with the University of Florida says backyard flocks can be infected by droppings or saliva from wild birds passing through.
California has been dealing with large outbreaks of H5N1 bird flu over the last year, so I would not advise people picking up backyard poultry for the first time unless they feel really good about the training they've received about doing it in a safe way.
Over the last month, more than 50 backyard flocks have tested positive for bird flu across the country. In December, a person in Louisiana who came in contact with dead birds from a backyard flock became the first American to die in this avian flu outbreak. The entire West Coast is part of the Pacific Flyway, which raises the risk of migratory wild birds coming into contact with backyard flocks. Professor Maurice Petesky is an expert in poultry disease modeling at the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. He says to protect your birds, you must practice good biosecurity and animal husbandry.
Not having spilled feed, having good fencing, having clothing and boots that are dedicated to going in the coop. Now I recommend that people also wear surgical masks and some kind of covering over their eyes.
Petesky says if more people got a flu shot, it would make it harder for the avian flu to mutate into a strain that human immune systems may not be able to fend off.
That can reduce the potential for human influenzas and avian influenzas to mix. And when they do mix, they have the potential for creating new strains that are novel, virulent, and highly infectious.
The CDC guidelines for backyard chicken owners recommend limiting human access to them and keeping poultry in enclosed spaces to minimize exposure to wild birds. This story was produced with original reporting by Gabriella Sotelo for Sentient. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The county wants your input on the budget for the upcoming fiscal year, which starts on July 1st. There are many ways to participate in the budget process. You can start by visiting the website engage.sandiegocounty.gov. to take a survey and to use a new tool to rank county budget priorities in order of importance to you. The survey also asks how you'd like to stay informed about the budget process, by email, text, or another form of communication. The survey will be open through March 28th. Survey results will be considered, along with community feedback gathered throughout the year as the county's recommended budget is developed. Other considerations include factors such as the availability of state and federal funding. The recommended budget for fiscal year 2025-26 will be released to the public on May 1st. The county budget in the current fiscal year totals over $8.5 billion. The county funds many programs and services in the region, which has a large unincorporated area in addition to 18 incorporated cities and 18 federally recognized tribes. In the unincorporated area, county government is responsible for law enforcement, roads, building permits, animal shelters, parks, libraries, and more. Some cities can contract with the county to provide these types of services. County government also provides many services that support the entire region to keep people safe and healthy. These include emergency preparedness, criminal prosecution and detention, delivery of federal and state social service assistance, access to food and housing for vulnerable people, health programs including behavioral health services, food and restaurant inspections, elections, and beach water monitoring. Funds from other government agencies make up about half the county's budget and must be used as directed. The other half comes mostly from property taxes, fees for services, and other sources. Some of these funds must be used in specific ways, and the county can decide how to invest the remaining portion to support the community. Those decisions are more challenging this year due to the rising cost and uncertainty at the state and federal levels. After the release of the recommended budget on May 1st, people can share their thoughts online by submitting comments through June 12th on the website engage.sandiegocounty.gov. You can also share your thoughts in person at upcoming community meetings or by attending or calling into the Board of Supervisors public budget hearings on June 3rd and June 9th. The Board's budget deliberations and adoption will take place on June 24th. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Henry Migala.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Terry Lawson Reamer, acting chair of the Board of Supervisors, held a public briefing last week to inform the community on how the Trump administration is disrupting essential local services in San Diego County. This includes active federal funding freezes, administrative delays, and policy changes, which Lawson Reamer warns are making it harder for the county to protect public health, provide housing assistance, and respond to emergencies. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, is refusing to release disaster relief funds, Lawson Reamer says, even after a federal court told them they had to do so. The frozen federal funds, including money for the Shelter and Services Program, which has forced closure of the migrant shelter run by the Jewish Family Service, leaving more people without a safe place to go and adding strain to our homelessness services. Lawson Reamer says the U.S. Centers for Disease Control has stopped communicating with San Diego County about critical public health data. They haven't released the results of a federal study on chemical exposures in the Tijuana River Valley. So if there's a toxic exposure, the county won't have the data needed to take action. In addition, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, has frozen grants for public housing agencies and removed essential resources that local housing programs rely on. That means delays in rental assistance and risks for affordable housing projects that were already in progress. Lawson Reamer says of these actions, "This isn't just frustrating, it's dangerous. The Trump administration is blocking federal funding that San Diegans already paid for, and instead of those dollars coming back to our community, Washington is playing games with the services people rely on, she concludes. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Susan Taylor.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Susan Taylor with a Crime Beat report. The Sheriff's Department seeks public help to find thieves who stole nearly $15,000 worth of jewelry and collectible coins from the owner's home at Hatfield Creek Vineyard and Winery in Ramona. Crime Stoppers is offering a $1,000 reward for information leading to the arrest of the thieves, who may have targeted two other Ramona wineries on the same day, February 23rd. The suspects are described as two heavy-set, possibly Hispanic men, said Sergeant Daniel Slopey. The men are believed to have committed the crime at Hatfield Creek Winery around 4 p.m. Between 3:45 and 5 p.m., two other wineries nearby, Barrel One Winery and Coricaminos Vineyard and Winery, both reported suspicious persons. The San Diego Union reports that the owner of the Barrel One Winery says two men in their 20s or 30s knocked on the door of her home that afternoon. They asked where the tasting room was, then drove off without visiting it. She described their vehicle as an older black four-door Mercedes-Benz. The owner of Coricaminos said her husband went into their home to feed their two dogs and found two young men inside. They ran off when the dogs barked, then drove away in a black sedan. Sergeant Slopey says no crime reports were filed on those two incidents because no thefts took place at the other two wineries. But he advises, as a precaution, deputies are conducting extra patrols at wineries in the Ramona area. Hatfield Creek Vineyards and Winery owner Elaine Littleton told the Union Tribune that the stolen jewelry includes an antique ring given to her mother by her godmother in 1925. That was my wedding band that can never be replaced with anything, she says. Other pieces were gifts bequeathed to Littleton by her best friend. Anyone with information about the home burglary or the stolen items is asked to call the San Diego County Sheriff's Office at 858-868-3200. You can also call the Crime Stoppers Anonymous tip line at 888-580-8477. Crime Stoppers is offering up to a $1,000 reward to anyone with information that leads to an arrest in this case. You can visit www.sdcrimestoppers with information that leads to an arrest.
This is Henry Migala with East County Magazine's Crime Beat Report. The sheriff's SWAT team was dispatched to a home on Old Highway 80 in Bankhead Springs near Hacumba on March 3rd, along with deputies serving a search warrant related to an investigation into an alleged assault with a deadly weapon. The search found numerous booby traps, homemade explosives, and firearms, says Lieutenant Jeff Ford with the San Diego County Sheriff's Department. The suspect, 40-year-old Ross Warren, was found hiding inside a wall along with a gun, a pellet gun, and an imitation firearm. Warren was arrested for assault with a deadly weapon, child endangerment, possessing and deploying booby traps, and multiple counts of possessing and manufacturing destructive devices. He has been booked into the San Diego Central Jail. His live-in girlfriend, Brenda Beltran, was also arrested for obstructing or delaying a peace officer. She was cited and released.
Sheriff's deputies arrested a man Sunday night for allegedly hijacking a Lyft driver at gunpoint in Lemon Grove, then assaulting and choking her. After being forced to drive around for approximately an hour, the Lyft driver stopped at a dispensary parking lot on Harris Street, where the rider tried to persuade bystanders to buy marijuana for him. The Lyft driver managed to text 911 secretly for help. Moments later, deputies arrived and arrested the driver, 10 News reports. For East County Magazine on KNSJ from Lemon Grove, this is Miriam Raftery. The American Federation of Teachers and the American Sociological Association are suing the Trump administration over a threat of funding cuts and investigations of schools that integrate diversity, equity, and inclusion into their policies or lessons. The letter schools received purports to reinforce anti-discrimination laws, but actually cast efforts to hire or help disadvantaged people of color as a form of discrimination, California News Service reports. Roderick Castro, Assistant Superintendent of Educational Services at Santa Rosa City Schools, noted that the letter criticizes using race as a factor in hiring and training. He says a letter like this is basically giving them the directive to abandon those. That cuts us off at the knees. We're looking for educators to be more representative of the students that are in the classrooms. It's a blow, more of a gut punch to us, he adds. The letter is critical of courses that involve certain racial groups. Castro says ethnic studies classes rightly lift up students' cultural heritage, and he said he thinks teachers and students should be free to examine the facts about topics like slavery or civil rights. Schools were given until last Friday to comply with the Trump administration's anti-DEI directive, and many colleges are pulling back, even reevaluating campus groups like the Black Student Union. Dr. Chuck Flores is an associate professor of educational administration at Cal State University, Los Angeles, and UCLA. He teaches social justice and educational leadership at Cal State LA. He says, we have to provide an open forum for all people of all races to discuss what it is that we need to achieve as a country. Eliminating DEI doesn't really go in that direction. Flores says, I just feel that we're going down a dark hole we're not going to be able to pull out of if people don't wake up and start taking a stand for what's right. The letter from the Department of Education also says diversity and social justice are not valid reasons to take race or a proxy for race into account for admissions and financial aid. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Advocates for small independent farmers are sounding the alarm about the effects of corporate agriculture on farmers and local communities. Four megacorporations now control the majority of livestock production in the U.S. American companies Tyson and Cargo, Brazilian-owned JBS, and Chinese-owned WH Group Limited. Justin Perkins is publisher of Barnraiser, a nonprofit newsroom dedicated to covering rural America.
These corporate monopolies are structured all across the agriculture industry, and this has made the livelihood of small and even medium-sized farmers nearly untenable.
The big agricultural firms argue that they have made the food system more efficient and profitable while keeping consumer prices low. But advocates argue that waste from the huge hog, cattle, and dairy farms, known as concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, pollute communities' air and water. Sonia Trom Ayers and her family have been farming in Minnesota for generations and fighting CAFOs for decades. In her book, Dodge County Incorporated, she describes the corporate system as a pyramid with big ag at the top and with integrators in the middle who own the supply chain and provide feed and veterinary services to farmers called contract growers at the base.
The multinationals reorganized the marketplace, created a closed system where all the profits flow to the top of this pyramid, and they can control the pricing that flows all the way down to the contract farmer and that contract grower down at the bottom.
Joe Maxwell co-founded the nonprofit Farm Action and says this vertical integration has created regional monopolies among meat packers and has driven tens of thousands of independent hog farmers out of business over the past few decades.
These meat packers, they own the system. They own the baby pig. They own the feed. They price gouge the consumer at the grocery store. They pollute the land. They are extracting the wealth from rural America.
Maxwell encourages people to take a stand with their local, state, and federal elected representatives in order to counter the influence of lobbyists for big agriculture. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for San Diego's inland region. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
This is Miriam Raftery with a business report. As President Donald Trump rolls out hefty tariffs on imported goods from America's biggest trading partners, Mexico, Canada, and China, American businesses and consumers are bearing the brunt, with higher prices on everything from steel and lumber to food and consumer products. The action has drawn opposition even from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, normally a staunch Republican ally. In a press release, the chamber warns tariffs on Canada and Mexico will have a real, devastating impact on thousands of small businesses across the nation and on all Americans in the form of higher prices. While the U.S. Chamber says it shares concerns about border security and the scourge of fentanyl, unfair trading practices, tariffs on Canada and Mexico will not solve those problems and instead would lead to higher prices for Americans, the business organization states. Chamber President and CEO Suzanne Clark, in her annual State of American Business Address, said pointedly, "The bottom line is this. Tariffs are a tax paid by Americans, and their broad and indiscriminate use would stifle growth at the worst possible time." She stressed that to boost American economic growth, "We must participate in the global economy. That includes seizing opportunities to increase trade." Trump signed an executive order on February 1st to impose 25% tariffs on imports from Canada and Mexico and 10% on Chinese imports. He did so by declaring a national emergency over undocumented immigration and drug trafficking. Trump later paused the Mexican and Canadian tariffs by 30 days and extended an additional 30-day exemption for the auto industry. China, meanwhile, countered by announcing hefty new duty charges on numerous American goods ranging from cars and agricultural machinery to crude oil, coal, and liquefied natural gas. Actions that hurt American companies. Next up, in mid-February, Trump announced a whopping 25% tariff on steel and aluminum imports, metals that are used in many consumer products from vehicles to cookware. He also called for reciprocal tariffs on any goods that other countries tax, a move that economists warn could create chaos for the global business community. He's also pledged to soon add tariffs on products from other countries, including a 25% tariff on some goods from our European allies, as well as tariffs on imports from India. On March 4th, Trump doubled the tariff on Chinese imports to 20%. After that, China imposed tariffs of up to 15% on numerous American farm imports, such as beef, chicken, and pork, and levied export controls on some two dozen American companies, Associated Press reports. Canada slapped tariffs on over $100 billion worth of American goods over just 21 days. One Canadian province removed all U.S.-made alcoholic beverages from store shelves, replacing them with Canadian liquor. Canadian travelers have begun canceling visits to the U.S., harming the U.S. tourism industry. Mexico's President Claudia Sheinbaum has said her country will also impose retaliatory tariffs, though she has not provided details yet. In early March, Trump postponed the 25% tariffs on some Mexican and Canadian imports for a month, crediting Mexico's president with working to reduce drug smuggling and illegal border crossings, although the U.S. has also ramped up border security under the Trump administration here. The impacts have sent the stock market tumbling, fueling fears of a recession. And Trump himself says he doesn't know if one can be avoided. The effects of the Trump tariffs are also being felt locally. Brent Schertzer, managing director of apartment developer Holland Partner Group, told the San Diego Union-Tribune that tariffs on steel and other building materials could add millions of dollars to large construction projects. He says the material suppliers will have no choice but to charge more for steel or risk going out of business. Alan Jin, a professor of economics at the University of San Diego, told KUSI Fox 5 that some of the biggest cost hikes for Americans will include vehicles, oil and gas, electronics, and groceries, further fueling the inflation that have already caused hardships for many U.S. households.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Welcome to East County Magazine's Destination East County, bringing you all of the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County each week. This is Miriam Raftery bringing you this week's Destination East County with all the most fun festivals and events coming up across East County. Fort Cross Old Timey Adventures in Santa Isabel, just outside of Julian, is offering farm tour adventures every Saturday this spring. The farm tour adventures include visits with farm animals, an interactive reptile show, archery, tomahawk throwing, paintballs at the Ghost Town Slingshot Range, a jug band, walking trails, tire swings, plant sales, and more. For reservations and tickets, you could visit fortcross.com. Julian Farm and Orchard invites you to Daffodil Days, held each Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from March 7th through April 17th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. In addition to you-pick daffodils, visitors can also enjoy other activities for a fee, including a petting zoo, rock climbing, swings, picnic areas, a tractor-pulled hayride, and more. Visit julianfarmandorchard.com. Mount Helix Park will host Nature Day atop Mount Helix on March 15th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. This event will feature live animals, a butterfly release, booths from over 30 nature organizations, activities, crafts, and a native plant sale. Shuttles for the public are available from Grossmont High School. Get details at mounthelixpark.org. That's mthelixpark.org. The Anza Borrego Desert Natural History Association invites you to the Borrego Home and Garden Tour on Saturday, March 15th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Explore four desert dwellings in the heart of Borrego Springs at your own pace. Each home showcases unique architecture, landscaping, and design elements. Tickets are available online at abdnha.org/garden tour. That stands for the Anza Borrego Desert Natural History Association. Fort Cross, New Julian invites you to St. Patrick's Lucky Adventures, March 17th. Participants can kick up your heels at an Irish jig, see snakes like those St. Patrick drove away from Ireland, target sneaky leprechauns at the Ghost Town Slingshot Gallery, and venture into a land of leprechaun magic as you seek to find special treasures. For tickets and more information, you can visit fortcross.com. Hooley's Irish Pubs in La Mesa and Rancho San Diego invites you to don your best green attire to join in celebrating St. Patrick's Day on March 17th with Irish music and more. Details will be posted at hooleys.com. Grossmont College's Theater Arts Department will present The Pirates of Penzance, a musical, on March 20th through 22nd and March 27th through 29th. This stage production of Gilbert and Sullivan's comic opera offers a rollicking good time with endearing pirates, bumbling policemen, zany escapades, and delightfully ridiculous paradoxes. For tickets and details, visit grossmont.edu/events. Alpine Country Crafts and Gifts invite you to a spring festival and Easter celebration at 2156 Alpine Boulevard. The event takes place Thursday, March 20th, Friday, March 21st, and Saturday, March 22nd. The Alwani Middle Eastern Orchestra will perform at Cuyamaca College Samuel Chakati Theater on March 27th at 7:30 p.m. Its mission is to counter negative narratives about the Middle East by showcasing the region's cultural richness through the transformative power of music. For tickets, visit GCCCD, that's Grossmont Community College District, gcccd.universitytickets.com. And finally, an onstage version of the popular TV game show The Price is Right is coming to Sequan with two shows March 29th at 3 p.m. and 8 p.m. Audience members will have a chance to hear their names called and to come on down to win major prizes. Tickets are available at sequan.com. That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
Our East County Magazine radio show needs volunteers, and so does our award-winning news website at eastcountymagazine.org. If you would like to help write scripts, learn reporting skills, research topics for our news team, or have an on-air voice to be the media, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617.
Next up, we're going to pause for some national news headline stories from Public News Service, and then we'll be back with more East County news.
The Public News Service DOA newscast for March the 10th, 2025. I'm Mike Clifford. President Donald Trump declined to rule out a recession this year as the economy stutters from his efforts to impose tariffs and rebuild the U.S. manufacturing sector. Acknowledging in an interview broadcast on Sunday, it takes a little time before Americans will see a payoff from his policies. That for the Washington Post. They report Trump's recognition of the turbulence in the U.S. economy was a reversal from previous cheering that his policies would deliver quick victories to voters and businesses. And it stood in contrast to reassurances from his own advisors Sunday that no recession was in sight. Next up this month, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments in a case that challenges the constitutionality of a federal fund that aids rural broadband service.
A conservative organization brought the case, hoping to end an SEC fee that flows into what's known as the Universal Service Fund. It provides $8 billion a year for telecommunications programs geared toward underserved populations. That includes high-speed internet service in rural areas. Kara Semler of the South Dakota Telecommunications Association worries about the impact if the challenge is successful.
Children will be missing out on educational opportunities. Businesses will lose their competitiveness.
Industry groups say service rates for customers benefiting from the fund will double if it's struck down. The plaintiffs contend the fee mechanism used to prop up the fund is more like a tax, meaning Congress should have the oversight. I'm Mike Moen.
And bird flu has now infected close to 1.7 million birds and hundreds of cattle herds, including some in Arizona.
Dozens of humans have been infected, but the risk remains low, according to the CDC. But some scientists are growing worried that could change. Former chief public health veterinarian for the USDA, Dr. Pat Basu, says as the Trump administration reviews federal government spending, animal disease outbreak research, such as the Animal Health and Disease Research Capacity Program, is being put in jeopardy.
The last thing we need is this control disease outbreak. And through this program, which is part of USDA, provides tens of billions of funding to states and to these organizations, universities, to carry out high-value research.
The AHDR program is funded by the National Institute for Food and Agriculture, which is a federal research and grant-making body. I'm Alex Gonzalez reporting.
This story was produced with original reporting by Gray Moran for Sentinel Law and Policy. And from Reuters, the Homeland Security Secretary, Kristi Noem, appointed new leadership at U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement on Sunday as the agency struggles to meet President Trump's stated goal of a massive deportation operation. This is Public News Service. Next, as federal government spending cuts loom, advocates for keeping Medicaid intact are calling attention to how the funding is used in public schools in states like New Jersey and nationwide.
Medicaid provides health insurance for more than 37 million children in the nation, but it's less well known that Medicaid funding also supports a number of services in public schools. Jennifer Higgins, president of American Federation of Teachers New Jersey, says threats to the Department of Education along with Medicaid funding would affect millions of kids.
School districts can bill Medicaid for therapeutic and other services such as speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy, audiologists, psychologists, social workers, and nurses. So when you combine the cuts to both, it's financially catastrophic to not only just New Jersey, but any state.
She says the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act funding supports more than 240,000 students in the state. Brett Pivoteau reporting.
The state estimates up to 700,000 New Jerseyans would be at risk of losing health care. And the Trump administration's recent executive order entitled Immediate Expansion of American Timber Production calls on federal land managers to ramp up timber production to protect the country's national and economic security.
Nick Cady is the legal director of Cascadia Wildlands in Eugene. He says the order's claim that onerous federal policies have forced the country to rely on imported lumber is incorrect. In fact, he says the U.S. is one of the world's leading timber exporters.
There are miles and miles of deck logs that are raw exported to Asia every day out of Coos Bay in the ports here in Oregon. So the premise which all of this is based on is false.
The order also states that a lack of logging has contributed to wildfires and degraded fish and wildlife habitats. Cascadia Wildlands and other environmental groups plan to take legal action against the order. I'm Isabel Charlet.
We head finally to Tennessee, where Disability Day on the Hill is an opportunity for people living with a disability to unite and engage in the legislative process.
The CDC reports nearly 1.6 million Tennesseans have a disability. Carrie Carlson with the Tennessee Disability Coalition says people are encouraged to meet them for the Disability Day on the Hill in Nashville. The event focuses on issues and challenges policies that threaten protections under the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Disability Day on the Hill is a day where hundreds of people with disabilities will come to Nashville, to Cordell Hall, and get involved in the legislative process, meaning having meetings with their Senate and House of Representatives.
For Public News Service, I'm Danielle Smith.
This is Mike Clifford. Thank you for starting your week with Public News Service, member and listener supported. Hear us on interesting radio stations, your favorite podcast platform. Find our content and trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
In what's been dubbed a Valentine's Day massacre, Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, has fired 1,000 National Park Service employees from the nation's 63 national parks, plus another 2,000 U.S. Forest Service workers. Additional cuts target Bureau of Land Management's 245 million acres on other federal public lands. The action is creating havoc, including here in California, which has more national parks than any other state. At Yosemite, where the cuts have forced temporary closure of four popular campgrounds, park employees hung an upside-down flag, a universal symbol of distress, atop El Capitan as crowds gathered for the annual popular firefall event. Gavitt Carpenter, a Yosemite maintenance worker who supplied that flag, told the San Francisco Chronicle, "It's not sustainable if we want to keep the parks open. We're bringing attention to the parks, which are every American's properties." Alex Wild is now the only ranger at Devil's Post Pile National Monument in California who is certified as an emergency medical technician. He told NBC, "I'm the only person available to rescue someone, to do CPR, to carry them out from a trail if they got injured. The cuts could mean life or death for someone who's having an emergency," he says. Fire prevention workers have also been let go, including Michael Mayerhofer, a Forest Service trail maintenance worker at the Bob Marshall Wilderness in Montana. He says his crew was dubbed a fire militia for its efforts to help with fires in the district, ranging from extinguishing abandoned campfires to aiding in larger wildfire suppression, Montana Free Press reports. Florissant Fossil Beds National Monument in Colorado has been forced to close 2 days a week due to lack of staffing now, the site posted on Facebook, while visitors to Zion National Park in Utah and many other parks found long lines of vehicles due to not enough staff to man entry booths, CNN and other media report. Wrangell St. Elias National Park and Preserve in Alaska, which encompasses more than 14 million acres, has had the only bush pilot fired. Bill Wade, executive director of the Association of National Park Rangers, told CNN, he asks, "Now how do we protect the wildlife and detect poaching activities or find somebody that's overdue in the park or climbers in distress and so forth?" Without enough rangers to patrol vast areas such as Yellowstone National Park, environmentalists fear poaching of endangered or threatened wildlife and destruction of sensitive plant species. Beth Pratt, California director of the National Wildlife Federation, recalls that when parks were closed during the COVID-19 pandemic and didn't have staffers, people were cutting down Joshua trees at Joshua National Park, she recalls, adding that graffiti, trash, and driving on protected meadowlands also occurred. Tim Whitehouse, executive director of Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, told NPR, "There's no real staffing plan, it's chaotic, and there's no leadership from the Secretary of the Interior." Fired workers accused DOGE of lying in claims of poor performance reviews, with many saying they had positive recent reviews. Andrea Townsend, a fired Yosemite specialist on carnivores, says it's a complete lie. Richard Midget, an IT specialist in Yellowstone who was also fired on February 14th, says he's done great work, including helping optimize Yellowstone's communication system and developing computer code to streamline onboarding and offboarding of employees. He believes his firing is both unwarranted and illegal. The layoffs present hardships for the thousands of employees let go, since most were low paid and moved long distances to work for the Park or Forest Service and now have no alternative jobs in the area. The National Federation of Federal Employees, the union representing Forest Service and National Park Service workers, has filed a lawsuit seeking to reverse the firings of those and other federal agency employees, a total the union said could impact a 500,000 federal workers, according to the Montana Free Press. The suit contends that DOGE and an executive order signed by President Donald Trump violates federal law outlining how federal workforce reductions must be handled, which requires action by Congress. The union's February 14th filing in U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia states there is no statute that expressly authorizes the president to slash roughly one quarter of the federal workforce, imperiling the statutory missions that Congress has assigned to federal agencies. The suit also contends that the executive branch's efforts to hobble agencies that Congress created by carrying out mass firings and a pressure campaign for resignations violates separation of power principles. Since the initial Valentine's Day mass firings, the Trump administration has backtracked partially, agreeing to hire nearly 3,000 seasonal workers for the summer season, Associated Press reports. But seasonal jobs are entry-level and won't make up for management-level employees fired, says Kristen Brengel, Senior Vice President of Government Affairs at the National Parks Conservation Association. Brengel told CNN, "You really can't have the seasonals without the other full-time staff people who are helping to manage them." Brengel notes that national parks were already short-staffed before the recent layoffs, operating with 20% fewer employees than in 2010. There was no fat to trim, she asserts. The cuts also come after the Trump administration has voiced support for opening up federal lands, including national forests, to mining, logging, oil, and gas drilling. Former National Parks employee Midget says, "It feels like if nothing is done to prevent this administration from dismantling our public lands and the support behind them, we could very well lose access to the trails, the mountains, the plains, and the wildlife that we all love so dearly." 20 congressional Democrats have signed a letter calling the cuts damaging and short-sighted and warning that the mass layoffs could cause staffing chaos in national parks and even lead to closure of some parks entirely. But Democrats lack power, since Republicans control both houses of Congress and the presidency. While most Republicans have been silent on the issue, Republican Senator Susan Collins from Maine has voiced concerns over the impacts on Acadia National Park in her state. Bill Wade, executive director of the Association of National Park Rangers, believes it's up to the public to take action and save America's most beloved places. "It's clear that the people of this country really love their national parks," he told CNN, "and now it's time for them to do something about it." Reporting for East County Magazine from KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history.
This is Miriam Raftery, guest hosting the Sounds of History on East County Magazine show on KNSJ. Now, if you think this week's storms were severe, just listen to this. Back in 1976, Hurricane Kathleen struck our region, the most powerful tropical cyclone ever to hit San Diego and Imperial counties. With winds up to 90 miles an hour, Hurricane Kathleen dropped a foot of water on Mount Laguna and sent a wall of water 10 feet high and 40 feet wide rushing through the town of Ocotillo in neighboring Imperial Valley, destroying over 70% of the town. Another wave a mile high and 2.5 feet wide swept through Jacumba, demolishing a farmhouse there. The San Diego Union-Tribune said of the Ocotillo nightmare, "There was no warning, just a sudden roar." The powerful storm killed 13 people in California and Mexico. It also washed out Interstate 8, crumbling the freeway and destroying a bridge at Meyer Creek, where a 600-foot-wide section of the freeway was wiped out, leaving a gully in its place about 40 feet deep. Eldo Sanders jumped in his truck to try and save people stranded in Painted Gorge out in Imperial Valley after hearing a call for help on his Citizens Band radio. He never made it. His truck was found overturned in mud, and his body was later found buried in a mud bank. Another resident of Ocotillo, John Patrick Riley, refused to evacuate his home. Rescuers from the Ocotillo Volunteer Fire Department found the 63-year-old man's body inside his home, which had flooded. An El Centro resident, William Mina, is believed to have died when his vehicle was swept off the Meyer Creek Bridge on Interstate 8 by a towering wall of water. Flooding and mudslides destroyed three bridges on the San Diego-Arizona Eastern Railway, ultimately leading to abandonment of that railway line. It smashed airplanes at desert airports and turned one plane on its nose in Yuma. A Salton Sea Resort area, Bombay Beach, was completely underwater. Authorities began referring to it as a lake. Most of the 14 cities in Imperial County were utterly inundated. Sheriff's deputies and the Navy airlifted residents out of areas west of El Centro, including an elderly woman trapped when water overflowed her bed. She was saved by sheriff deputies in a flatboat. In San Diego, the storm shut down a Padres game. Out in Imperial Valley, farmers suffered when at least 10,000 acres of sugar beets were wiped out along with many other crops. All routes out of Imperial County except for State Route 111 were shut down all at one time. 80 families were left homeless in Mexicali, and roofs blew off homes 600 miles south of San Diego. Hundreds of homes were destroyed across the region by the powerful storm, which caused $160 million in damage, ranking as one of the worst storms in California history. Alan Zangheim grew up on a ranch in Imperial Valley, and he recalls the flash flood that raced across the desert floor on September 9, 1976. The next morning, he remembers going outside with his dad, believing that the storm had passed. And then he writes on his website, "We kept noticing some sunlight reflecting off the San Diego Mountains out towards the west. It was like a sparkle. My dad thought it was peculiar, and he said it looks like water. And we listened to the radio shortly thereafter and heard the flash flood warnings. My mom was scared and pretty insistent that we vacate the ranch, and we did. We returned to find out the next morning that a wall of water approximately 10 feet high swept across the Imperial Valley desert floor, wiping out the town of Ocotillo and killing some motorists who were unfortunate enough to be on Interstate 8 at the time the water came through. When we returned to our ranch, it was under 3 feet of water, and my dad's crops were ruined. It was due to this catastrophic incident that we sold our ranch and moved to the San Diego area," Zangheim recalls. He warns that due to the unique geography of Ocotillo, which sits on an alluvial fan below sea level, the same unfortunate events could very well happen again. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, this is the news from rural America. The number of American farms has fallen 7% over 5 years, and a freeze on National Conservation Service grants could make that worse. Under court order, the Trump administration released $20 million of the $20 billion it froze. But Mike Lavender with the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition says countless farmers still have been left angry and confused by the indiscriminate funding block.
We're seeing contract terminations, contract modifications, harming rural communities, farm families in the long term.
Dan Lotspeech used federal grants to build 3 greenhouses in rural Nevada, where he grows fruits and vegetables for local farmers' markets.
I genuinely think this business wouldn't exist if it was not for the government, the USDA, filling that investor role where it's kind of missing from the private sector.
But Lotspeech says the funding freeze leaves his plans to expand his all-weather farm looking cloudy. The Department of Government Efficiency, led by Elon Musk, has fired thousands of probationary Forest Service workers, citing poor performance, despite positive performance reviews. Alana Newman has more on the impact for rural communities.
Outdoor recreation adds $1 trillion to the economy, but without Forest Service employees to clean bathrooms, maintain trails, and support firefighters, rural communities could lose tourism. Cyrus Isari was terminated at New Mexico's Gila National Forest.
The Gila National Forest is already severely understaffed. This has made it even worse.
No wildland firefighters were terminated, but nearly everyone at the Forest Service is specifically authorized to support firefighting. And Isari says he and the crew were hardly a waste of taxpayer money.
My crew, we are hard workers that are doing so much, and our rural communities depend a lot on us.
I'm Ilana Newman.
This loss of Forest Service support is especially critical, as climate change means more wildfires, and rural communities rarely have the money to prepare. But 2 years ago, Congress and the Biden administration authorized the U.S. Forest Service's Community Wildfire Defense Grant Program. Kelly Pohl leads the nonprofit research group Headwaters Economics.
This program really stands out for successfully getting funding to communities that need the resources and that were really prioritized by Congress.
Since 2022, the program's awarded $420 million to rural communities to reduce fire danger around homes and neighborhoods and implement their own defense projects. But since President Trump announced a federal funding freeze, the program is in limbo, which Pohl says will hurt as fire season ramps up.
And they need the resources now. Wildfires won't wait.
For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown. For more rural stories, visit dailyyonder.com.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal. Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road. AK Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music. Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod. April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection. And Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.